I want to talk about David Isay. We've had a lot of metaphors today, music and composition, and I want to talk about choreography, which was a word that Alan actually also used, in relation to the work of a feature maker called David Isay, I want to in particular look at one of his programs, a program called The Sunshine Hotel that he made in 1998. From the end of the 19th century up until the middle of the 20th century, the Bowery, situated on Manhattan's Lower East Side, was the world's most infamous skid row. A 16-block stretch of New York City, it was full of barber schools, bars, missions, slop houses, cheap eating joints, tattoo parlors, and flophouse hotels. The estimates vary, but at the peak of its notoriety, up to about 75,000 homeless men slept on the Bowery every night. Today it's changed, it's become gentrified. Many of the bars have gone, the barber schools have gone, as have the tattoo parlours and most of the flop houses. The poorest hotel accommodation you can buy. A single room occupancy for a man for as little as $4.50 a night. During the Depression there were about 100 flop houses on the Bowery. The choice for guests was usually one, a cot in an overcrowded barracks-like dormitory, which was the cheapest option, although there were more bedbugs, or two, a cubicle smaller than a prison cell with a bed, a locker, and a single light bulb hanging through the chicken wire. Chicken wire was there because there was a gap between the cubicles, and the chicken wire was there to keep people from crawling into the next cubicle. These places historically grew out of the American Civil War, which created homelessness on a vast scale. But the Second World War largely put an end to the Bowery Skid Row era. Legislation in 1955 created a law which prohibited the building of new hotels with cubicles. Existing flops became hostels or were converted into office space. By the end of the last century, in the 1990s, there were only 8 flop houses remaining on the Bowery. The White House, the Palace, the Andrews, the Prince, the Sun, the Grand, the Providence, and the Sunshine Hotel. In 1998, the independent radio producer David Isay made a feature about one of these surviving establishments for National Public Radio. He chose the Sunshine Hotel at 241 Bowery, a flophouse which had opened in 1922 and which, under its manager, Nathan Smith, had barely changed in 80 years. Over a period of months, Isay and his assistant producer, Stacey Abrahamson, worked at the Sunshine, recording interviews with the residents and with Nathan himself, who narrated the finished programme, which was broadcast in 1998. I want to discuss the results of this programme, play some extracts, and actually develop the idea, which is already inherent in much of the work of Charles Parker, that such radio as this shapes and structures witness of how people live in a way that provides a vital bridge into the recording of oral history. I'd like to show specifically how this has happened in the later work of David Isay, with the StoryCorps Oral History Project now running in the United States, which had its direct roots in this and other of Isay's NPR programs, placing him in a tradition of personal narrative radio, which includes Ira Glass of This American Life and Studs Terkel. I've chosen the Sunshine Hotel as the focus for this because, for me, it sums up much of Isay's work in its ability, like the work of Charles Parker and Ewan McColl, to establish the subjects or enable the subjects really to tell their own stories. At the same time, again, like the authors of the radio ballads, it shows the authorship of the producer, the conscious searching out, crafting and making of the setting for what Charles Parker referred to once as the jewel in the ring, of the spoken witness placed in its most effective context. There is some found music in this feature, but music is not a narrative thread as it is in the ballads. Everyone who's ever made a radio feature will identify with the wonder that is the narrator that he found. There is, I think, a god of radio program makers who occasionally passes to a producer a certain personality, a certain character that is actually what the program finishes up being about. And in this case, that person was Nathan Smith. He narrates the programme partly through actuality-found speech and partly through light scripting, which he manages extremely well. Around him, the Sunshine gets on with its life. And voices come and go, interject, find themselves juxtaposed at times through production with Smith's conversation and explanation, much in the same way that in the ballad of John Axon, at times the music is informed and complemented by a single word or phrase. The whole programme lasts 25 minutes, and it starts like this.
Welcome, come on in. If you got the rent money, you can stay. If you ain't, beat it. This is an eat it and beat it hotel. Normally, people come in, they stay for a day or two and get out. But for some reason or another, people come in, they like to stay for a year, for 2 years. You know, in other words, they like to give you aggravations. If you like aggravations, come to the Sunshine Hotel. It's a lovely place.
Yeah, I didn't like the fleas in the bed.
Fleas?
Yeah, I had fleas. I scratched all night the whole time I was here. Yeah, roaches on the wall. I mean,
it's a nice place if you're short of funds and you need to lay your head down for a couple of hours. We hope to make your stay pleasant. But don't ask me for towels or soap. We don't have it. We do not have those luxuries.
You want a CID of any kind?
No, I believe you. I mean, this is the kind of hotel where everybody gives an AKA. You're welcome to a room for a very nominal fee. Okay, here are my friend. You're okay. All set.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Okay, you can square yourself away, this, that, and the other. This is the last of the last. Well, welcome to the Sunshine Hotel.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. The last of the last.
I'm Henry, by the way.
Henry, yeah. Nathan.
How you
okay,
doing,
my friend.
Please meet you.
Okay.
It's a logical way to start a program, but already in that short sequence, less than 90 seconds, the producer establishes the style and mood of the feature. Nathan becomes our guide. He's not just the manager, he lives in the place himself too. And his relationship with the men in the hotel is one of paternal sympathy. We have one thing in common, he says, we are all on our own. With Issei's telling of the Sunshine, while the stories remain central and paramount and often heartbreaking, there's a clear, urgent reason for making this programme, to chronicle something that was about to disappear forever. A few other flop houses might survive a few more years, but the Sunshine Hotel, with its three barracks, dormitories and lines of cubicles, was the last hotel on the Bowery offering specifically this type of accommodation. As the programme demands of us, Nathan Smith's view is sympathetic and non-judgmental. If, in Icy's own words, the hotel is the most raucous of all the flops and often feels on the brink of chaos, it was, at the time the programme was made, a near-perfectly preserved remnant of old New York, in Icy's words. And like the characters in Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of St. Louis Ray, everyone has a story that brought them to where they are today.
If it wasn't for this hotel, a lot of these guys wouldn't have any place to go. All you have to do is look around, like over there. You see that old guy there with the snow white hair and the guitar? This is Eddie Barrett. Eddie's been with us about 100 years.
It's a new day, sunshine, and the world's still here, we're still here, so that's good. Hey.
Eddie sits all day in a corner of the hotel, looking out the window and playing.
I play like Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash, that's my inspiration, Johnny Cash.
The funny thing about Eddie is that he always plays the same songs over and over and over again.
Maybe I might sit down and come up with a new tune in my mind, but by the time I pick up the guitar, I don't forget the tune I had in my mind, see?
Eddie used to work as a band boy for Tito Puente, but he had a mental breakdown and ended up at this flop.
I met a nice guy in the street, and he knew the Bowery. And he told me, he said, look, you looking for a hotel? I said, come on with me, I'll show you a hotel. There's a place called Sunshine. It ain't bad. So we went together, and that's how we started.
That was 30 years ago. Eddie's still here.
Everyone has a story, like Vincent Giganti.
Vinny, this is Vinny here. What? Vinny Giganti, yeah. Cubicle 25A. Yeah. Vinny has throat cancer and talks with a voice box. Has Vinny, you know.
This is the manager. He's the best guy here, bro. I've been here 7 years. This man's like my adopted father, and he'll tell you.
Vinny looks a lot like the famous mob boss, Vincent the Chin Giganti. He claims that the guy's his uncle, although I don't know.
I came here because I was addicted to heroin. I didn't want to bother my family anymore, so I've been here since then, and I will be here until I die, probably.
That chirping sound you hear is Vinny's two lovebirds. He spends all day in his cubicle taking care of.
This is Pretty Boy. He's 10 years old. This is Little Vin. He's 5. He's a devil. Yes, you are. They take good care of each other. If it wasn't for these birds, I don't think I'd have made it in this place. These birds have been my life. So many people don't realize you need something, you know, to help you through everything, or you're not gonna make it.
Something amazingly poignant about that. Everyone has a story. And the point about Nathan's narration is that he's a part of the place. This is not some voice of God professional presenter, but a man who is as much a part of this story as anyone else. The script in the narration from time to time, but way I'd sooner hear Nathan's script than anyone else's. No judgments. Everyone and anything can end up in a place like this. I say, as always, like to allow his subjects to tell their own story. But he's not a formulaic producer. He doesn't work it to templates. In 1993, he produced a program called Ghetto Life 101, for which he gave two Chicago teenagers, Leallen Jones, age 13, and Lloyd Newman, 14, tape machines on which they recorded audio diaries of their life in Chicago's East Side for 10 days. The candor of the boys' diaries brought listeners face to face with the reality of being a child in one of Chicago's worst housing projects. You really need to hear the whole program, and you can actually hear it online, but you hear the boys there talking to friends, family, and others, eliciting a frankness about their situation, which is shocking because it is so matter-of-fact. In this short clip, Lloyd is interviewing his often absent, drunken father.
Why are you drinking?
I don't understand why I'm drinking.
Do you think you're going to stop?
Yeah, I'm going in rehab and take care of myself.
What do you drink?
I drink about 2 or 3 pints of wine a day. But it ain't helping me. It ain't doing what killing me. Do people understand it's destroying you?
If it's destroying you, why do you still drink it then?
That's why I got to go in the rehab program next week, because I don't want to destroy my family, because I want my family.
Do you think you've been a good father?
Yes, I have, to the best capability I could.
I have no further questions.
The roots of the Sunshine Hotel and Ghetto Life 101 can be found in David Isay's work for the NPR series All Things Considered during the 1990s. In a series hosted by Susan Stamberg, Isay set out to record the stories of people across the United States. From 1990 came a program recorded with lifers in the Louisiana State Penitentiary at the town of Angola. What made these men's story was so painful was that at the time many of them were sentenced during the 1950s and 1960s, life imprisonment was interpreted by the authorities as being a fixed term. With good behavior, you got release. Then, with exquisite timing, shortly before a number of the prisoners were due to be released, the state changed the law. From that point, life meant life. So men on the verge of freedom found themselves facing the rest of their mortal lives in prison. Where do you find hope in a situation like that? Here's an extract from Tossing Away the Keys, featuring the voice of convicted murderer Maurice Bickham, recorded 18 years ago.
Wake up, Carl, let's go, get up! Out of bed, let's go! Wake up, come on, let's go!
Let's get back in line!
Come over here. I want to introduce you to the beautiful rose bush on the whole yard. This is one here. It's my favorite. I named it after my wife, Ernestine. It's a beautiful pink rose. And somewhere or another, I keep it trimmed and uniform up until I call it my beauty. I know it sounds funny, but these are my company keepers. I enjoy these bushes. See, if it wasn't for these bushes, I wouldn't have nothing to do. So these bushes have come to be close, very close to them.
My name is Maurice Bickham. My number is 75251, and I'm 72 years old. I've been in prison ever since 1958. My crime is murder of two white deputies in a small town called Mandeville. They was dragons of the Ku Klux Klan, and I was a black man living in a white neighborhood, and they came to my house to kill me. They shot me with my hands up, and I fell and loaded my gun, and I shot him. So here I am, 31 years later, and I'm still locked up. I remember when my first gray hair came in my head. I was up here, I was in jail in 1960. It came right up in front where I could see it good. By 1961, I had one in my mustache. By 63, I had gray hairs all over my head. I've had three heart attacks since I've been here. The big one was in 1977 when the pardon board turned me down. Since I've been locked up, I lost all my family mostly. I can see losing my mother and father, but all my sisters and brothers, all my aunts and uncles. God bless me now. The judge is dead, the DA is dead, the lawyer's dead. Everybody's passed on but me. And when I look at it, I say, Lord, why I'm still here? It makes you wonder.
So, where has this taken David Isay? The answer to that is to an oral history project called StoryCorps. It's a project to collect stories from people from all over the United States. Ordinary people, everyday people, people like you and me. And it has grown directly out of the radio work that Isay and colleagues developed during the 1990s, because everyone has a story. The idea has been to set up a series of recording booths in key locations across the states, augmented by a mobile unit which travels to areas where there are no booths. Since 2003, when this scheme started, over 30,000 everyday people have shared their life stories in this way, and life-changing stories. Family, friends, potentially posterity with these story booths, as they're called. There still aren't that many around, but booths are opening on a rarely quite regular basis. The first two were in Grand Central Station and Ground Zero, New York. The website, www.storycorps.net, is regularly updated as the network spreads. For the storytellers themselves, the people who turn up to record their story, the deal is always the same. Each contribution is recorded and two CD copies are made. One is given to the donor to keep. The other is stored in the special collection in the Library of Congress. In addition, a selection of the stories is broadcast on a weekly basis on NPR. There's also a podcast to subscribe to on the website. They can be funny stories, moving, dramatic, provocative. Perhaps unsurprisingly, major events yield some of the most touching stories. There are pages of personal accounts from survivors and bereaved following 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina. But there are others which tell stories that make you smile. For instance, the man who went to a Ray Charles concert, fell in love with one of the Raylettes and married her. And here's a sample podcast just pulled off the site, more or less at random, called The Misery of Rain. It's framed, as all these podcasts are, by the opening and closing annos, just as you hear it if you go online.
StoryCorps is made possible through major funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, through the support of participants and listeners like you.
Hello, and welcome to the StoryCorps podcast. In this episode, the story of a changed life. It begins in the 1980s, when George Hill left the Marines. He became addicted to drugs and alcohol, and found himself living on the streets of Los Angeles.
I was homeless 12 years, and I can't even begin to tell you the misery of rain. I don't even care how slight the rainfall is. It was misery beyond belief. And then sometimes you sleep during the day because it's warm enough to sleep, and then at night you keep moving so you don't freeze. And I used to watch people get on the buses, and I used to say, you know, those are normal people. And you felt anything but normal. One time, I just happened to be sitting on this bag, because if you didn't carry your blankets or your jackets around in the bag, they were gone. And here comes a homeless man. So dirty, it was just awful. I mean, his hands were like black with the exception of his knuckles and joints where the bone that kind of rubbed through the dirt. He had rags tied on his feet and his hair was matted in two big nasty dreads. And out of all the people in Skid Row, he looked down at me and reached in his pocket and pulled out a dollar and change. That's all he had. And he gave it to me and said, "Here, man, I feel sorry for you." And he shuffled away. Something about that moment changed everything. I just said, "Oh, no, 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 no. I'm going to get some help." With that dollar and change, I caught the bus and I went to the psych unit in the hospital. You know, I still think about it sometimes, and I don't have regrets for anything that happened, because going through the homelessness just made me so grateful, determined, thankful. And now, every time it rains and I have keys in my pocket, I have a joy of life that you cannot believe.
There's a point where everyday speech becomes poetry. Projects like StoryCorps and Connecting Histories that we were hearing about earlier demonstrate how vital, in both senses of the word, spoken language can be. I've talked before about the importance and the potential of the developing community radio stations currently opening up all over Britain. Perhaps a project like StoryCorps could operate here, using these stations in place of the booths that ISAE's team are setting up in the States. The infrastructure of the existing stations as recorders of stories would need to be augmented with a central digital repository for the material linked to a website. But in theory, it's a possible. So what about the Sunshine Hotel? It's quite hard to find any information now. At the time of ISAE's program, Nathan Smith was already suffering from lung cancer. Last year, Michael Dominic, a filmmaker who followed in ISAE's footsteps to the Sunshine and made a feature television program about them, said he'd heard that the place was due to close down within a few months. Emails to the hotel come back unanswered, and remember that Nathan said it was the last of the last. Which all goes to prove just how crucial it is to do the interview, to make the program, partly because it makes wonderful radio, but probably more importantly, because these things, these people, everything is so fragile. And there's a time limit to all things mortal. We should do it because we can. It's the lesson of the archivist. It's a responsibility. Charles Parker, I think, would agree. Thank you very much.